Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're going to tackle some things that have been at the top of the news for many of us, starting with what happened in Spokane, Washington, has created this furor around the country and why, and what it says about race in our culture. Yesterday I joined Melissa Harris Perry at MSNBC to wrestle with this topic as well. One of the things people question is how you define the issue of how you define race in America today. What does race mean? That we have, for the last 500 years, had this definition of race in the world. Didn't exist before now. Divisions of black, white, African, European. They were things that were created out of Spain and Europe that created a whole world that affects all of our consciousness and the consciousness of this nation today and the world, not just this nation. And I think in some ways what we saw now with Rachel Dolezal was that what happened to her, to me, is not a mistake of what in this 21st century, at this moment, as we're struggling with so many things in America. I think this is part of a social wave and thinking and movement that's taking place. What does it all mean? And I think part of it is we're coming to grips, maybe for the first time in the history of this country, with the fact that we're not a European nation, but we are have been and always will be an Afro-Indo-European nation. That is who we are. That's what we've become. That's what we started in the 13 colonies. That's where it all began. But it was always being defined by its whiteness. Now we're being defined by more than that, and people are in a state of confusion and change and rage all at once. So we are here with Kalima Young, director of the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project, project in the Office of Community Engagement at Maryland Institute College of Art. Kalima, always good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist E.R. Shipp is in the studio, journalist in residence now, and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University School of Global Journalism. Good to see you again, Shipp.
Good morning.
Adar Ayera is with us again, project manager of More in the Middle Campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships. Adar, lovely to have you back.
Good morning. Thank you.
Your voice makes me feel bad. I hope you feel better soon. But just
I do too. Thank you.
And Rain Alexander's in the studio as well, Baltimore-based artist and arts organizer. Rain, great to see you.
Thanks for being having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on your Facebook pages. Send us an email at talk@steinershow.org. But do call at 410-319-8888. So let's begin. We talked before the head of the show, Kalima. This is, to me, a very – it's complex. All right. I'm not going to try to get into Rachel Dolezal's head about why she did what she did. The joke I made to you before we went on the air was she might have been able to pass in Spokane. It wouldn't have worked so well in Baltimore. Given the nature of Spokane, Washington, it's interesting because she was a kind of an anti-racist, anti-fascist fighter for much of her time in that whole kind of very white racist fascist area in Idaho and Washington. But it is a complexity that's made people everywhere start questioning, what do we mean by race?
And I think that it's, like you said, there's no mistake that it's happening right now, that we're actually having this larger conversation. It's impossible at this point for us to divorce race and the way race and the formation of race structures our very society, everything that we do, where we stand. And at this point, culturally, I think we're truly, we have a little more tools. People are starting to have more tools to be able to talk about race, think about race, understand it as a construct, understand how it's institutionally and structurally works its way through the system. And now that we're having more of a conversation about it and we have more language to use it, we're also being exposed to people who are taking it to an entirely different level. That's the nicest way that I'm going to put that.
Totally different level. Ship?
I'm not sure. Well, it's been kind of fascinating on a lot of levels here. It's not often, and some friends and I tried to talk about this weekend. We are very comfortable in our blackness, and I don't know of anyone who I know who would not want to be something else. But having said that, we find it hard to understand why someone would easily give up the privileges that come with being something else, in this case, white, in order to take on an identity that they know comes with a lot of baggage, a lot of disadvantages. So we've been wrestling with the meaning of that. How does it call into question our own valuing of what we are as black people? Should we welcome those who want to come in and be one of us? Or should we think, as it's so easy to do if you're kind of in a Comedy Central mode, that she's obviously crazy to want to take on this identity? So we're wrestling with this, what it means to your own sense of blackness when you see someone else taking on the identity and you call into question their motives.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dog, go ahead, then we'll turn to Rain.
You know, one thing I read on Twitter that had me laughing out loud was never has anyone gotten this much attention for attempting to be black, only a white person. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is true. And I also think what she is doing is an ultimate in white privilege and unearned white entitlement when you can, without any genetic African-American markers, claim to be black, mm-hmm. and to have people support that. And that's such an important thing to note, Mark, because most African-Americans whose families came through the Maafa are 29% genetically European. I am. I cannot go out of my house or go anywhere and say, you know what, I am a white woman, and have that be believed or have that be my social reality or my political reality. No one can unless they have white skin privilege. So the fact that white people can, on whatever whim, regardless of motive, claim another racial identity and be believed and be supported says a lot about the currency of whiteness in our society still.
I think one of the things that interests me about this is, I mean, we can't obviously get inside her head, and she hasn't spoken about her motives at all. And until we do, we won't really know too much more. But leaving aside any of that behavior, the thing that mystifies me is that she needed to elevate herself to a position of leadership. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the things, you know, as somebody who is working in the arts and is attempting to use all of my capabilities to, within my sphere of influence, to advance social justice causes and that sort of a thing, I mean, I have a certain amount of leadership, but I would never imagine putting myself in that kind of place that she did. And that's something that really I'm really interested to hear when she does finally speak, why she needed to do that particular thing.
And she did, by the way, put off the meeting they were supposed to have tonight. And many members of the local NAACP in Spokane were kind of outraged, saying you have no right to cancel the meeting. The meeting needs to take place. But there's a controversy obviously going on within the organization itself at this moment. What are we gonna
say?
You
know, I was going to say it's rather interesting. The NAACP was founded largely by white philanthropists and led by white people for the earliest years.
Yes, right. Yes.
W.E.B. Du Bois was the only black person in a leadership position as they started out.
Yes.
So it's kind of an odd thing that it's the NAACP that is now calling into question a white person in leadership.
Mm. Oh. I can't divorce this conversation or Rachel Dalzell and her ascendancy to leadership from an overall conversation about abolitionist strategies and how, because I'm sort of thinking about what's going on with that underlying desire to take on blackness. And, you know, one question I've been wrestling with is like, is colonization of blackness the only way for her to work against anti-blackness? Because in abolitionist movements, there was always this push to create and really create this identification with the struggle, with the pained people who were being tortured in chattel slavery, that there was this unhealthy sort of desire to be in the shoes of those who are the most oppressed. Like the only way that they could push abolitionist tracks through was to talk about how very tortured black people were. And to some extent, the abolitionists, white abolitionists, had some kind of desire and identification with that. And that's the only thing that propelled them to do anti-slavery work. And so I often think a lot about this in terms of Rachel Dalzell being in that space of the old abolitionist movement of I've got to feel that oppression and I have some kind of weird desire to feel that, but she can take it off. She can take off the oppression. That's the privilege that she's working within. But I don't see it divorced from the history of how anti-slavery work happened and how abolitionist movements were working as well.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, and I'm going to open the phone here, then I'll come back with some thoughts.
And it's not that hasn't just happened in African American communities, particularly when the country was coming out of the Holocaust in Europe. There were people who claimed to have been Holocaust survivors who were not, and they assumed those identities. There were other people in the United States who assumed identities of blackness. Black people, identity theft. So this isn't something new. This is just something that we're hearing. But the danger in this, Mark, other than the wholesale racial identity theft, is that then you have people who are interpreting and reinterpreting blackness, mm-hmm. still from their perspective of whiteness, instead of black people telling our own stories, being our own selves. I know that everybody black at this table has heard the phrase, they will take everything but the oppression. Yes. Now it turns out they're wanting to claim the oppression too, when it's convenient.
So let me open the phones here, and I'm going to try to push a different spin on this and see what people think. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Ricardo, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Ricardo. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, yes. Okay, this is going to hurt a little bit, but it's the way it is.
Go ahead.
All right. American, we're talking about racism in America. Okay, wait, hold on. Okay. First off, black and white, they're political statements. That's what I meant to get out. Black and white are political statements. All right. Now, blacks have passed for years, you know, when you get a certain complexion. But basically, you are what you defend. I'm a little nervous, so I'm not speaking as well as I should.
It's okay.
We have had in the past, there was a cowboy who was Italian who passed for black because he liked the culture and it suited his. He was a movie star. But what I'm saying is, blacks are, if you're politically black, black and white are political statements. And also, the sham of American race is, it's unscientific. Race in America is based on greed. It's not really based on your complexion. We're going to have to watch this lady. We're going to have to do that. But I almost applaud her because you can almost tell that she finds it beautiful. And politically, if she is black, then she is black, whoever you are. Regardless of your complexion, if you are 100% politically black, you are black. Same thing with white. We can pass and have passed. They can pass and probably have passed in the past, too. But that's what I had to say.
Ricardo, thank you so much. And please join us here, 410-319-8888.
I would caution against false equivalencies. There have been instances of what we call passing, which is really interesting because, again, going back to those markers, people who have passed because they have been white. They have had white genetic markers, which showed up in their phenotype, right? So it's not that they weren't white, quote unquote, they were white enough to pass. So they had some white ancestors, and so they passed. It was only because of the one drop rule in American society, which kept them from being accepted and acknowledged as white in America, even though they were, for all essence in terms of how they looked, white. Rachel Dolezal is not African descendant, not in any way. And so please, please, let's not deal in false equivalencies.
Well, you don't have to deal with false equivalencies there to look at this whole notion of passing over the years. It's generally been black people who felt that they could only succeed in whatever field they chose by being something other than black, who then were able to do that. But I
But why were they able to do that?
I'm sorry?
Why were they able to do that?
They were able to do that because of the way they looked. And I was going to say that reminded me of a series that the New Orleans Times-Picayune did some years ago where they looked at some people there who had common ancestors, but based upon their complexion, they were either classified as white, Black, or Creole. And the series followed how their lives had flowed from those definitions, when indeed they all had common ancestors. Race is a very fluid kind of identity sometimes here, and I think that's what we're trying to, what we are seeing with this instance out in Washington, that some people can slip it on and off at will, sometimes for a good motive. There have been instances where light-skinned blacks were able to go in posing as white in order to be able to rent properties and then make sure that other blacks were able to come in. That happened in some parts of Harlem in the early 20th century. And you see, I think even Walter White of the NAACP was pale enough to be white, and he used that to his advantage sometimes, too. It's been an interesting thing over the years to see, sometimes for good, as I would see it, and sometimes probably for less altruistic means.
I mean, the other part here, and I, do you want to jump in and say something, Cleveland, before
I
did?
Oh, I was just really quick. I was just going to say, I just find it interesting that she found it more appealing to take on a black identity and do anti-racist work than have to be on the margins of whiteness, being as anti-racist as she was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's, to me, that feels like that's bad allyship. You know, living in the margins, it's hard to be so pro-black and to be white and not be ostracized. And we all know white folks who are so down for the struggle that they don't get the white privilege. Their white privileges get contested by other white people. So the fact that she felt more comfortable taking on a black identity and appropriating as much blackness as possible, as opposed to living in that uncomfortable spot of being a white ally who's going to get ostracized by white people for being such a white ally, that's what I find problematic.
One of the things I don't want to do even know what was going on in Rachel Dolezal's mind or what was motivating her to do what she did.
Right.
I just don't know. It could be any number of things. But I think that what we talked about before we went on the air is that there's this country, I just got back from Cuba the other month. This time in Cuba, I spent a lot of time with people who are Santerias, who are Santeras. Santeria is an African-based religion that came out of the anti-slavery struggle and the resistance in Cuba of the 19th century and is a very powerfully huge spiritual path in Cuba. And so a lot of the Santeras I met were what we would call white. And then the response to me was, from some of the Santeras, was Santeria is not a black religion. It's a religion based on black on African philosophy. It's a religion for all people. It's part of a spiritual cultural path that we choose to take. And then one of the leading figures said the difference is between us and you in America is that the reason that the tensions are so crazier in America than they may be in Cuba or Puerto Rico or some other places is because we didn't experience the racial terror that you experienced in America. That defines a lot of this. All being based on race, which we know is spurious. That doesn't exist. There is no race. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no, to me, and I'll be pushing further, there is no Europeanness. There is no Africanness. It's all made up. It's all part of the 20th century conjecture, 19th century conjecture of what to divide the world up. But it never existed before that. This is a new construct that has invaded the hearts and souls of our country and our world. And so that's created this place where when people like Rachel see that the fight against oppression, the fight against the resisting what's going on in America is seen through the black world, many people who are not black, not just white people, many who are not black, identify with that world deeply and say, that's where I belong. I mean, that's part of the dynamic it's the complexity of that dynamic, I think, that we're wrestling with right here. We have to take a break. I'll let you jump back in that. And we'll go to Bernadette and Donna and Barry. And more, 410-319-8888. And we want to also tackle the whole issue. People, especially conservatives, have pushed in the transgender issues as being similar to this. And well, it rained wax on that a bit, too. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back.
I'd like to add his initial to my monogram. Tell me.
come back. It was a good day. So is this Ice Cube. Happy birthday. Born on this day in 1969. And on the way to break, Someone to Watch Over Me, a good song to hear by Ella Fitzgerald, who passed away on this day in 1996. And we are here with Rain Alexander, Adar Ayira, Ship, and Kalima Young to talk about what's been going on in Spokane and more places. 410-319-8888. I want to get to the phones. I want to pull in the issue around transgender issues and how people are trying to push that as an equivalency here and deal with that. But you were about to say what, Kalima?
Oh, I was just going to say the difficulties we run into when we all understand that race is socially constructed and we can theorize about it, but we cannot divorce it from the materiality of how it exists in everyday lives. And that's where this Rachel Dolezal is really causing a controversy for everyone, because it's that conversation about the theorizing and the racial theory that we can all have all day long, and then actually how it plays out materiality in our lives and the inequities that are a part of that. So I think that's why this conversation becomes so difficult for us to have.
It's a very tough conversation to have for America to have, for America to have with itself. But I think that's one of the, it's a good thing this happened, because I think it opens up doors of ability to do analysis and thinking for time to come, and not just based around this poor woman's world and what she has gone through and is going through and has put her friends and other people through. I mean, this is, I think this is a very important issue.
And absolutely. And well, I think that the point that Kalima just made is where I think a lot of people are conflating this with transgender issues as well, because you've got the materiality of this point of identity, which all of us are participating in, just as all of us are participating in some kind of racial identity. We're all also participating in some kind of gender identity. Mm-hmm. Whether we're conscious of it or not, whether we're moving between things or not is you know, kind of beside the point. We're all participating. And, you know, perhaps it's just the proximity of the Caitlyn Jenner story and the Rachel story that is really making people immediately go to this place. You know, and of course, I guess everybody likes to feel scandalized as well. so there's that. But, you know, I do wonder if there was some distance, if there was, you know, 3 or 4 months worth of distance, would we have had as many people jumping immediately to that point?
That's a good point, Rain. We may not. I mean, there could be the proximity of those two things happening back to back, and the explosiveness around both of them for America, because they challenge our notions of what it means to be whatever we are in this century. I mean, but, and so they did get conflated.
But some of the people doing the conflating, I think, are doing it in such a way to distract from the serious conversations we ought to be having about each of those subjects.
Absolutely.
Because they can say, oh, look, you know, anybody can be anything, and they don't look at the more serious issues involved in that identity. Mm-hmm. Even in Bruce Jenner becoming Caitlyn Jenner, there's a lot more serious issues there than the flippant, oh, he can just be anything he wants to be kind of thing. He's the only Kardashian on the cover of Vogue in clothes or something like that, right? So people would rather joke than to be serious about the topic.
And there,
let me get to the phones, but go ahead. Very
and
quickly.
There is a very real lived difference if you are a white, rich, transgendered person and an African-American transgender person. We talk about these things as if there is an equal, a level playing field, and there is not. And if we do not frame it in acknowledgement of those who are privileged and what this means and those who are not and what that means, then we really are not having real conversation.
But can you just frame it? We see this. I think there's a danger of being linear either way. You know, you can be linear either way. That if you are transgender in this country, if you are gay in this country, if you're a lesbian in this country, I don't care if you are Black, Native American, Puerto Rican, or white, you are going to be discriminated against by the majority, by many people. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But you can't, but then that, but what you just raised is what always gets left out of the conversation, which cannot be left out of the conversation.
Right. And none of this is linear. All of it is intersectional.
Exactly.
And we don't talk about it from that perspective. But within that intersection, race has so much meaning. And so to leave the intersectionality out of it and to leave the lived experience and the primacy of race as experienced in people's lives out of it, we're not having real conversation if we do either.
You can, given the race as it was constructed to create slavery, to create capitalism, how it's permeated the nature of society completely, you can never leave it out. Mm-hmm. Then you can't be honest about anything if you leave it out.
Right.
That's why some people have a hard time with these conversations, because people want to leave it out.
Mm-hmm.
Why does everything have to be about race? Well, the answer is because most everything
is. Because it is about race.
410-319-8888. Bernadette, line two, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say that this situation makes me reflect on why a white woman would deem it better for her to pass as African American. And by her skin color, she would be considered a light-skinned African American. How does that reflect on how we feel about the variations in our own skin color, and what advantages it has to be a light-skinned American, of African American? Evidently, she deemed it better for her to be successful as a light-skinned African-American than as a white woman. She went through an African-American college, and I just think on that situation.
Right.
And I also kind of agree with the caller or the speaker that suggested that was her motivation behind this being that it would be easier to be pro-black.
Okay.
As an African-American, as opposed to being a white liberalist.
I think that's an interesting point. Kalima, you want to jump in? Or?
Oh. I think the conversation of colorism is really important.
Yep.
And I think the caller is definitely on point that there are advantages that oftentimes our issues of colorism and internalized racism have in terms of who gets uplifted and who doesn't. So I think that's definitely an interesting point.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've come across a lot of white people who would identify and who do identify as white anti-racist. And there is a reward in being a white anti-racist around people of color. There isn't a lot of reward in being a white anti-racist doing the work in white communities. And so you do get something out of it when you take your work as a person of privilege and surround yourself with those people on whose behalf you think you are doing the work. And so she has just taken this, whatever her motivation, she has taken it to an extreme. So the point of the conversation and the point that people are having problems with is her lie. Is her lie in doing that? And in our conversations, regardless of how this is framed in so many media sources, people aren't talking about the lie of it. We're talking about everything else but. And that is the thing that people are upset about. She lied in doing this work. She lied in misrepresenting herself. She racially stole an identity that was not her own. And most importantly, she did not need to do that to do the work. If the work was her motivation, she did not need to do that to do the work that she's doing.
But it seems that there's something else there, that there's something else that we don't know because we don't know enough of the story. There's obviously something going on within her family. It was her parents who apparently brought this to the public's attention in the first place, and they're having some back and forth about whether she acknowledges them as her biological parents. And it sounds as if she has rejected them for whatever reason and has decided that some black people are her parents that she feels more close to. So it's a complicated personal issue, I think, that she's having that's probably divorced from all the conversations we're now having about the bigger meaning of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Rain, before we go back to the phones.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. I feel like I'm anxious to hear what she has to say, and I feel a lot of compassion for her in that regard, because suddenly, you know, the weight of a country's, you know, racial history is coming down on her shoulders, obviously because she did things that she shouldn't have. But, you know, all of this family drama is going to get dragged out, you know, and it seems to me that there's going to be a lot of it, which, you know, I want to know, but I also don't. I want her to just
It's a train wreck that we're watching.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But, you know, she's carried this. She went to Howard University, I understand. She teaches African-American studies. She has taken this to a great extreme, and in her heart of hearts, maybe she thinks she is African-American. Even something I saw where she was asked to identify herself racially, she checked off all the boxes. Many of us could probably do that, and nobody pays attention, really. But so in one way, she didn't really lie. She's saying she's everybody. She's everything. She's American.
Let me go to the phones here. Hollis Robbins and I had this email conversation this morning. I don't know if you all know Hollis or not. She's head of African studies, Africana studies at Hopkins. She wrote in saying, you know, when I was a Victorianist, nobody ever asked me if I were wearing, if I were going to start wearing a corset or using smelling salts. Since becoming a scholar of African-American literature, I've been asked all manner of personal things by all manner of people. This is all I have to say on the subject, except that half the internet could use smelling salts right now.
Yes. That reminds me of the Sharon Patricia Holland quote. She's like, the catch-22 about race. It renders theorizing about it impossible because it stabilizes identity for those who impose it and those who work to expose it. Mm. And that is why we have such, that's why we all need some smelling salts right now, because that's where we are.
Let me open the phones, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Grace, and then we'll go to Renee. Grace, you're on the air.
Only thing I can say about this young lady is that she was raised with her mother and father. They're white. She is white. She went to school, to white school. She's been around all whites. And I have a feeling that this young lady grew up in a family home with hatred or something about blacks, and she turned against her parents. She don't speak to her parents for a couple years, and I don't think she still speak to her parents, because when they showed her father picture and said, this is your father, she smiled and she said yes, but she had no comment about it. And I think that this young lady went through hell with growing up, and she decided to be turned as a black African because she saw how the black people suffer so much, and she saw the way she was raised. She didn't like it. She stayed away from her parents. She didn't speak to her parents, and I think that she should still remain as a leadership in the NAACP. I don't think she should resign, and I don't think she lied. Well, she did tell that she lied in one way about the race, but this lady, we do not know what caused her to change her race, and this is something she has to tell the world if she wished to tell. So I give her all the credit to do what she felt that it was right, because black went through hell, and she decided to go that way. So God knows why she did it. So
Grace,
thank you.
Thank you so much, Grace. Always great to hear from you. Thank you. Let me get another call in here before we come back. 410-319-8888. Renee, you're on the air.
Morning.
Good morning, Renee.
I really feel like we give this way too much credence. I don't honestly, I'm an African-American woman, been well-educated actually, have a degree in Afro-American studies, and I really honestly don't have a huge issue with what she has done. It seems as though she has embraced a culture that so many say is not worth embracing. Even as African-Americans, we don't want to embrace our own culture. So now we see someone who honestly seems to be, for all apparent reasons, really enamored with the fact that she is a part of the African-American culture, the part of the dynamic, and that she can make some And she believes that she can make change happen. I mean, as the leader of this particular branch of the NAACP, I struggle. Where my struggle is that I feel like so many people are saying that, you know, this is the ultimate of white supremacy. I feel like as African Americans, we need to stop buying into this idea of white supremacy. Do I believe it exists? Yes, I do. But why can't we embrace black supremacy? Why can't we, or not black supremacy, how about just human supremacy? I guess I'm not being very articulate with that right now. Why, I feel like we buy into this and we give into this that white is better. And we consistently do this, especially when we have our leaders and so-called, you know, educators pontificating and doing absolutely nothing or saying nothing, really, honestly. You know, if this woman feels as though she can make change and she feels as though she can make change and also embrace a culture that so many black women try to run away from, i.e. perms and hair color, whatever have you, I mean, why are we even having an issue with her? So, honestly, if she can do the work, more power to her.
Renee, thank you so much for your thoughts. Let's come back to the panel and we'll come back to another caller here before we run out of time.
And the question, I don't think the question has really come up or is being debated about whether she can do the work. Shipp has pointed out that there has always been leadership, white leadership in the NAACP. So that's not the issue. The work that she has done and from all reports has done very effectively could have been done without a racial identity theft. It could have been done in her role as a white woman. It is the lie. That's what it is. And you can appreciate without appropriating and without stealing. You can do that. She would still be effective in doing that.
Anybody else?
I mean, I tend to agree. I feel like in the work that I do as a trans woman and as a queer person, you know, I really try to reach out to the constituencies and the audiences. They're not already in my little echo chamber, you know, it's great to speak to other trans audiences and other queer audiences, but, you know, where I have a sphere of influence within those areas outside of that realm, that's where I feel like I have the most power and the most generative power and really just speaking my own, you know, my own truth. And, you know, I feel like maybe she's going to be at a point now where she can actually, you know, speak about why she did what she did and kind of move past it if she's able to get through like that. What seems like it'll be a very weighty emotional experience, you know, maybe at that point her words are going to have more value and she's going to be able to help work within white communities to really get beyond their own, you know. I mean, as Kalima, as we've been talking here, it is a really difficult thing in white communities to talk about race and to do this work without, you know, somehow feeling out of place. And I think that's work she should be doing. That's work we should all be doing.
410-319-8888. Barry, you're on the air. Line three. Is it three? Yes.
Hi, Mark. And hi to you guys. I just want to be a little cautious about having a litmus test for what it is to be or to fight the fight. I'm with the other lady that just called. If she's doing the work and in the trenches, I don't care what she calls herself. There are folks that I know, Clarence Thomas to name one, who denies pretty much everything about his struggle and our struggle, and yet he has a position of power, and it just bothers me that if folks are willing to do whatever, if she has her little quirks and idiosyncrasies, I can go with that. I want to see what work she's done, and if she's done it, give her a medal and move on. And if she wants to be a character and call herself black, I'm okay with that.
Barry, thanks so much. Shipp, what are you thinking?
I don't know. We black people have always had a big tent. We say all yeah. are welcome to come in.
Yep,
and
always.
We've always done that. Mm-hmm. When we were kicked out of white churches or not felt welcome in white churches and formed our own, we said that we were open to everybody, and we have been. So that's kind of our tradition. And it's maybe true. That's partly what the response will be from a lot of people. Anybody who wants to come in, come join us. But I do understand the deeper questions, though, about who can call themselves one thing or another, what are the privileges that come with that identity, and why should it matter in the first place? We know that it does matter. Mm-hmm. The larger question is, why should it matter? And we haven't quite gotten there yet.
I think that part, what you just said, Chip, is... Clement, please jump in. I can see you get ready.
I'm just adjusting myself.
What Chip was just saying is really interesting, in that because it is true, the other part of the conversation we're not having is that the whole question of race in the history of this world is a complex one, and as we've been talking about, and that part of the resistance of the African world in the Western Hemisphere to what has happened these last 600 years, 500 years, part of that resistance, not all of it, has been defined by this tent. Mm-hmm. And that's very true. The tent has always been there. And I think that you saw that in Reconstruction. You saw that even when in the abolition movement, the debates happened between white and black abolitionists, but what black abolitionists did in that movement, you saw it in the civil rights movement. I mean, the tent has always been there. Mm-hmm. I saw it in Chicago when I worked with the Young Patriots and the Appalachian Whites, who some of them came out of the Klan, who united with the Panthers to fight oppression in Chicago and do Resurrection City. The tent has always been there. That is a part, the other part of the story.
Right. Our tent is there. The tent is huge, and we welcome everyone into the tent. But it's okay to critique the tent. We have to critique the tent, human people in this world. That's what we need to do. It's not distracting from the struggle to critique the struggle. It's not distracting from the struggle to get down with the struggle and ask people about their intentions and motivations in the struggle. This does not take away from the work that we do. If we weren't having this conversation about what's happening in this giant tent, we wouldn't be able to talk about transgender rights. We want to have a space to talk about how black femininity is always co-opted and malleable for everyone. Mm-hmm. We want to have an opportunity to talk about colorism. Like, we need to critique the tent, y'all. So no one is saying, I'm sorry, she was down for the struggle, but just she shouldn't be a part of this movement. This is what we do. We let people in. But we have to be critical about everyone under the tent, and we got to talk about it, and we got to use this as an opportunity. And I think that's why we're doing it. That's why we're sitting in this room right now, is to use it as an opportunity to critique our beautiful, lovely black tent of anti-racism.
And for me, the conversation isn't even about our tent. It is about the privileges of whiteness, because this is a conversation about privilege. When you see me, when you look at me, what do you see? How would you identify me? I'm asking. Y'all are here.
Sexy.
How would you identify me? Oh. That goes without being said. But other than that.
In terms of race,
in terms of race,
African-American.
How would you identify? You would identify me as African-American. In truth, I could identify myself just as much as being white. But in America, in lived experience, I cannot go out my door and do that. I do not have that privilege. And genetically, I can say that I am white. Genetically, Rachel Dolezal cannot say that she is black. So again, this is a privileged conversation. Who holds it and who does not? And that's something that we're not talking about. We're not talking about our still living in the world in which one privilege of whiteness is to shape and reshape reality in accordance to how folk want it to be. And so we're saying, oh, she can call herself whatever she wants. Well, you know what? She can. But my question is, so then why can't everybody else? She lied about who she was. She's not African American. She's not. She may identify with it. She may love the culture. Hey, more power to her. That's not the question here. The question is, number one, a lie. Number two, the privilege behind that lie. And number three, the fact that you have African Americans, 29%, who can claim some white, quote unquote, blood, but genetics, and would never be identified or receive the privileges that this woman receives. this is a privileged conversation.
I think that – I mean, I've listened to kind of the arguments and this gigantic argument around this taking place from a number of different perspectives and over the last couple of weeks, and again yesterday at MSNBC in New York, where it was really very broad in the question of what do you – Melissa Harris-Perry raised the question, then what do you call somebody who is white who is raised in a black world like a sister of hers, and that's her world. So who is she? What is she? Because her skin is white and she's European descended, does that mean that she is white? And what does that mean? I mean, I like, you know, that we have to take a very short break. I'm going to come back and finish the conversation, try to get a call in here and get the four of you to close this out so we can move into a Black Girls Lives Matters conversation we have to have here in the studio coming up next. So we're going to come right back to that. So stay with us on our way through here. We're going to hear Radiohead from their album Hail to the Thief, which was number one on this day in 2003. The title of the album was a reference to George W. Bush. To put the world to rights, I stay home forever, but two always makes a five. I lay down the tracks, sound. African American Classical Music Day. That was from William Grant Still's opera, a Bayou Legend. And on this day in 1981, it became the first opera composed by an African American to be performed on national television by the great William Grant Still. And I'm Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more with our guest to conclude this conversation that we started in the last hour, Kalima Young, E.R. Shipp, Adar Ayera, Rain Alexander with us in studio. Let's get a quick call in here and then. And then we'll come back and conclude with the four of you and move into Black Girls Lives Matters. Let's go to Washington, D.C. Tori, you're on the air.
I just wanted to make a very brief comment, and my comment is, like the one of your hosts there stated, we're talking about privilege, and I think that's the new buzzword for this post-racial, quote-unquote, after President Obama took office, but it's still, we're dealing with racial constructs from, you know, that were created back when the country was founded. And I guess for me, with regard to what Rachel did, I think it definitely speaks to her psyche in that she felt she refused or decided to appropriate our culture, our heritage, our history for her own purpose, even as far as creating these elaborate stories about identifying with 12 years of slave, even literally telling people how 12 years of slaves should be viewed, right. You know, sending herself hate mail. So for me, she basically undid all of the good things that she was doing by pretending to be an American of African descent, as opposed to just fighting from her position of, to use your caller's word, privilege, or, you know, taking on the weight. If you want to take on the struggle, take on the weight under your true identity, you know, of being an American of European descent, and fight from that position and work in your community to educate the people who are maintaining the system, you know, this racial construct of racial superiority right. system. Don't come to our community and appropriate. I mean, we to me, for those of us who are African American or Americans of African descent, we say, well, it doesn't matter to me, you know, who she is or what she's doing. We can look at all the vestiges of our heritage and culture, and we always lose. We share our music, and now we're no longer in control of it. We share our talents. We're no longer in control of it. We share all of our gifts and our talents, and we always lose, which is the goal of appropriation. It's taken, it's used, and they take it for their own use, and then ultimately say, well, we did this. It's pop music, no longer R&B. It's, you know, all these other variations. So in that I don't have respect for her and what she did. I think she should go see a psychiatrist and seek out help. But until she gets her mind right, I don't think she should stand up for anyone, get herself together, and then, you know, stand in her truth and fight from the position that she's in.
Tori, thanks so much.
I appreciate
the call. And these two tweets, then we'll come back to our panel. Black Pope tweeted in, "You can't choose your race or ethnicity. She could have been just as effective if she portrayed herself as a white ally." And tweeted again saying, Black Pope tweeted in saying that she did was deceptive and dishonest. Leadership requires integrity and credibility. She has to step down, is what Black Pope tweeted in. And our closing thoughts here. Rain, we'll go around the room.
Sure. I think that, you know, I spent a lot of time. I mean, comedy is part of my art and part of the work that I do. And I definitely felt like I needed to remain silent and not do any hot takes on this particular thing as it was coming through. And I think that it's real. I mean, and I'm so glad that I did. And I wish that many of my peers had kind of taken that time to not make a joke, because it's so easy. I mean, as we discovered last week with some of the stuff around Caitlyn Jenner, you know, so many people are quick to make this, you know, encapsulate it into a Twitter joke. And, you know, there's a lot more to it. And the point that I haven't gotten to, I guess, is that in some of the reading that I've done this past few days, there's people who are really experiencing what she did as violent. And I'm really interested in elaborating on that particular idea and the way that this was violent in very similar ways to what happened in McKinney. And so, you know, I think some investigation on that is definitely in order.
Your ship.
Well, I think that we have to separate her personal issues from the questions we're actually talking about today, and that is the meaning of race, the meaning of privilege. Those are conversations that will be ongoing, and I hope that whatever the results or the revelations that we hear about why she did what she did, I hope that does not distract us from actually still continuing the conversations we're beginning now.
Mm-hmm. Adora Ayira.
And I hope that the conversations can be thoughtful ones where the script has flipped and where we start concentrating not just on her and her specific story, but concentrating on racial privilege, who gets to have it, who doesn't, and what that identity really means in America, where whiteness is still currency.
And I just urge us all to take these as opportunities to expand the conversation. Be critical. Interrogate your own privileges as you're in the conversation. Read and be critical of what you're reading and who's putting that news out there. And understand that this is not a one and done. These are ongoing discussions that we need to have if we're going to do anything to start addressing inequality in our society.
I thank the four of you so much for being here today as usual, but also for the work that the four of you do in our world. I think that you do critical work in our world. And I thank you for taking your valuable time to be in the studio with us today and for our listeners and us. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
Kalima Young, E.R. Shipp, Adora Ayira, Rain Alexander. Thank you. It's a great panel. Thank you so much. We are taking a brief break here. We are going to break with "It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing," great Ella Fitzgerald, who left us on this day in 1996. We're going to look at the movement building Black Girls Lives Matter. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It makes a difference if it's sweet or hot. Just give that rhythm everything you got. Oh, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Don't mean a thing, all you gotta do is sing. It makes a difference if it's sweet or hot. Just give that rhythm everything you got. Oh, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I.